The latest from New Orleans.
Federal law enforcement and the intelligence community are actively investigating any foreign or domestic contacts and connection that could possibly be relevant to the attack.
Protesters take to the streets in Tel Aviv.
And there does seem to be a sense in the Israeli public of people just growing angrier and more frustrated that this war is continuing. It's now 15 months.
And the effort to shrink the size of the U.S. government.
During his first term, Donald Trump ordered a federal hiring freeze and other cuts. Now he wants his Department of Government Efficiency to finish the job. Some question the wisdom of taking a business approach to running the government.
Today is Monday, January 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. As New Orleans heals from the deadly truck attack on New Year's morning, the investigation into the killer's motive continues. On Monday, President Joe Biden visits the city, where he'll meet with victims' families. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the latest.
Closed-circuit video captures the moment when 42-year-old U.S. Army veteran Shamsuddin Jabbar rammed his truck into crowds of people early New Year's Day in New Orleans. A black Islamic State banner was recovered from the truck, prompting the FBI to investigate this as an act of terror. U.S. President Joe Biden says federal agencies are investigating all possible links.
Federal law enforcement and the intelligence community are actively investigating any foreign or domestic contacts and connections that could possibly be relevant to the attack. We're going to continue to relentlessly pursue ISIS and other terrorist organizations where they are, and they'll find no safe harbor here.
14 people died in the attack and dozens were injured. Jabbar suffered a fatal gunshot wound after opening fire on police. The FBI says Jabbar stashed improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, in drink coolers, one of which they say he placed at a busy intersection. The Department of Homeland Security says this is another case of what it calls homegrown violent extremism. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas.
It is a very difficult threat landscape, and it is why that we as a community, not just the federal government, but state and local officials and residents need to be alert to it and take the precautions necessary to avoid violence from occurring.
Later on New Year's Day and more than 2,000 kilometers away in Nevada, U.S. Army Green Beret Matthew Livelsberger drove a rented Tesla Cybertruck to the Trump International Las Vegas Hotel. The Clark County coroner confirmed the highly decorated Livelsberger, whom officials say suffered from PTSD, died from a self-inflicted gunshot before the truck exploded. Officials say no one else was seriously hurt. Law enforcement says there are so far no links between the attacks. People in New Orleans held a party-like vigil for the victims of the New Year's Day attack. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden plan to visit the city on Monday. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The political firestorm in South Korea is continuing. Over the weekend, impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol's security detail would not turn him over to authorities trying to execute an arrest warrant. For the latest, I'm joined by VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
Yeah, it's a pretty confusing standoff. I mean, essentially, there has been a warrant for Yoon's arrest, a court-approved warrant, for nearly a week. And they did make one attempt late last week to detain him. However, the security and some military personnel, which are tasked with guarding Yoon's residence, basically prevented an arrest. The arresting team, which was made up of investigators and police, about 100 of them, were met at the residence, and they were able to fight past the first layer of security. But then whenever they got to the inner compound, there was basically a human barricade that prevented them from going any further. Yoon and his legal team says this is an illegitimate process. They want it to play out. It's part of a separate process because Yoon is also, in addition to facing these insurrection charges for which he is being attempted to be detained, also has been impeached. So Yoon believes that he should actually let this impeachment process play out, but wants nothing to do with the arrest process. So essentially, the warrant expires later today. It's early Monday here in Seoul. late Monday that warrant expires. We don't know yet whether there will be another attempt to detain Yoon, but if there is, it could be quite dramatic.
So how can one law enforcement body, Yoon's guards, defy a court order?
It has been a month of asking questions just like that about South Korean politics. There has been constitutional crisis after constitutional crisis. And I know that word, that phrase, is sometimes overused in certain contexts. It's really not here. We are in unprecedented territory every few days in a new and fresh and disturbing way. I don't really have a satisfying answer for that, and I don't know how this process will be resolved.
It's probably no surprise that Yoon doesn't want to go to jail and is taking steps to avoid that, but what do the Korean people think? Are they supportive of Yoon in this standoff, or do they want to see him get taken in?
So the polls have shown that Yoon is broadly unpopular, but that's nothing new. I mean, he's been in power for 2.5 years, and he has been unpopular for a very long time. After his attempt to declare martial law, his polls did go down significantly. However, since the impeachment, strangely enough, his approval rating has actually bounced back up closer to what it was pre-martial law. It seems that he may have the support of enough conservatives to be able to make this more complicated for the South Korean political elite on the right. Yoon still has large groups of supporters on the streets who are vowing to protect him, some even making sort of extreme statements, vowing to physically protect him and prevent arrests and things like that. However, it's important to remember that his approval rating remains very low. He faces two separate processes which could remove him from power, both in the form of that insurrection investigation and impeachment, and his chances of succeeding this and actually getting, you know, coming away still as president of South Korea are very low.
And we'll leave it there for today. VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul. Bill, thanks for taking the time to join us today. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Moving now to Israel. This weekend in Tel Aviv, thousands took to the streets demanding Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu make a deal to end the war and bring the hostages home. This after Hamas released a video showing one of the hostages taken on October 7th is alive, and as an Israeli delegation prepares to head to Qatar, purportedly to put the finishing touches on a deal that would end the fighting in Gaza and see the hostages released. For more, I spoke with VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
There are 100 hostages being held, although it's not clear how many of them are still alive. Now, there is a report from Reuters just a little while ago that Hamas has agreed to a list of 34 names that Israel has been demanding, which would mean that there are 34 hostages alive. One of the names on that list is Liri Albag. Liri was one of five what they call spotters, kind of combat intelligence soldiers who were kidnapped from a base right near Gaza. And until now, it wasn't clear what had happened to them, if they were still alive. And Hamas released a video showing that she is still alive. She seems to be in a very difficult physical and mental state. And but, you know, for her parents to see that video and to see her, but at the same time, they said that this was not the daughter that they had known. And they can see that she has really had a very, very difficult time in captivity. But this video was released just before the usual Saturday night protests. And her parents spoke to the crowd of thousands in Tel Aviv and demanded that the Israeli government sign a deal to end the war in Gaza with a ceasefire and for the release of any of the all of the remaining hostages.
But it seems the protests this weekend were bigger and angrier than they've been more recently.
Yeah, there seems to be kind of a sense of growing frustration with the Israeli government And I think the families who have been so, you know, the families of the hostages who have been key to these protests are growing increasingly desperate. And they say that if Israel waits much longer, there won't be any hostages alive to give back. And it comes at the same time as American administration officials are basically saying how frustrated they are that the deal on the table today is basically the same deal that was on the table 6 months ago, and that there could have been a deal 6 months ago, but both Israel and Hamas have been stubborn and have refused to move towards a deal. And there does seem to be a sense in the Israeli public of people just growing angrier and more frustrated that this war is continuing. It's now 15 months. And in addition, the economic toll of the war is really starting to be felt in people's pockets as well, with increased taxes and things like that.
And all this is happening as a delegation went back to Qatar to negotiate again. Is there any sense of what it is they're looking to achieve? As you said, the same deal has been on the table for 6 months. What else is Israel looking for?
Well, the truth is that the head of the Mossad, Dudi Barnea, is supposed to go back to Qatar either tomorrow or the next day. And if that happens, then it's really a sign that there may be a deal. I mean, there, you know, the Israeli press is talking about a possible deal in days. And I think there's a sense in Israel that militarily they've basically gone as far as they can in Gaza. There is now currently a ceasefire in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and that the only front really still actively firing is the Houthis in Yemen, which has been firing missiles at Israel, most of which have been shot down before they reach Israel. But I think there is kind of a sense that it's time to end the war, that whatever can be achieved militarily has been achieved, and now Israel says it can make more gains with some kind of a diplomatic deal.
The war and the hostages are but one issue Netanyahu's facing. A lot of these protests are calling for new elections, saying he, Netanyahu, is anti-democratic. They're upset with the way he's running the government. They're upset with the changes to the judiciary he wanted before the war, some of the lingering from that political fallout. How much of the protests going on are about the war and about the hostages, and how much of it is just a sort of a general disagreement with Netanyahu?
Well, I think it's all kind of coalesced. I think that, you know, Netanyahu has consistently refused to appoint a commission of inquiry, a state commission of inquiry into what happened on October 7th, how the intelligence failed to know that Hamas was planning this. Hamas apparently, had been planning this invasion of Israel for years. And apparently Hezbollah was planning a similar invasion. How was the intelligence so wrong when there were all kinds of intelligence warnings? And Netanyahu has consistently refused to take personal responsibility for this. The military has been carrying out their own inquiry. But I think a lot of people in Israel feel that it's quite unconscionable that the government that presided over this, the biggest intelligence failure in Israel's history, is still in power 15 months later. And again, the judicial overhaul or the judicial reform, depending where it's coming from, which was before the war, was kind of put on hold during the war, and now seems to be starting up again, which would take power away from the Supreme Court and give more power to the Knesset. Another big issue is whether or not the ultra-Orthodox will be drafted. There's a lot of anger against Netanyahu because he seems to be moving towards a law that would actually legally allow the ultra-Orthodox not to serve in the army and to get all kinds of, you know, financial government benefits in order to keep his coalition together. And in addition, he's on trial in three different cases for fraud and breach of trust. It's the first time that a sitting Israeli prime minister is actually on trial. So all of these things seem to be coming together into a growing, increasing anger at him.
We'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting tonight.
Thank you, Steve.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Russia said Sunday that Ukraine has launched a new counterattack in the Kursk region aimed at repelling Russian and North Korean troops trying to retake territory that Kyiv's forces captured last August. Moscow said its forces defeated the Ukrainians, although news accounts said the outcome of the fighting was uncertain. Andriy Yermak, the Ukrainian presidential chief of staff, said that Russia is getting what it deserves. A massive winter storm moving across the United States will not keep the U.S. Congress from meeting Monday to formally certify Republican Donald Trump's election as president. This according to newly re-elected Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. On Sunday, he said the Electoral Count Act requires this on January 6th at 1 p.m. So whether we're in a blizzard or not, we're going to be in that chamber making sure this is done. The Mozambique opposition leader, who's led more than 2 months of deadly protests against disputed election results from outside the country, announced on Sunday that he will return ahead of the inauguration of the new president, Daniel Chapo. Venancio Mondlane, who left Mozambique after his lawyer was gunned down on October 19th, said in a Facebook Live address he would arrive at Maputo's Mavelane Airport on Thursday from self-exile in an unknown location. Mondlane called for demonstrations against the results of the October 9th election, which he says were rigged in favor of the ruling Frelimo Party, in power for over 50 years. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at American politics and the coming presidential transition. President-elect Donald Trump has said he wants to slash government spending. A proposed advisory commission called the Department of Government Efficiency, headed by Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, will lead that effort. But in politics, as in life, there is nothing new under the sun. American leaders have tried to reduce the size and the role of the federal government since almost the beginning. VOA's Dora McQuarrie reports.
Billionaire businessman Elon Musk wants to slash $2 trillion in federal spending. He'll be co-head of the Department of Government Efficiency, a proposed Donald Trump presidential advisory commission. It's not the first time a U.S. administration has pledged to cut government expenses, says Justin Vaughn, an associate professor of political science at Coastal Carolina University in South Carolina.
Presidents have been talking in one way or another about downsizing or reducing the role of government since the founding of the republic.
It started with America's third president, Thomas Jefferson, in the early 1800s. Jefferson eliminated some military and government jobs, temporarily lowering costs.
I'm convinced that at least 4 million have been given employment.
In the 1930s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt expanded the federal workforce to cope with the Great Depression. Roosevelt's New Deal employed millions, providing relief for the poor while stimulating the economy. The jobs ended once the crisis was over.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan formed the Grace Commission, asking the group of about 150 business leaders to find ways to eliminate inefficiency. Tom Schatz is president of the group Citizens Against Government Waste.
President Reagan asked the Grace Commission to look at the government with an eye towards making it work more like a business.
But the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library website says that most of the recommendations, especially those requiring legislation from Congress, were never implemented. Still, some historians say Reagan succeeded in shifting the national conversation in favor of a smaller role for the federal government in solving public problems. According to Vaughn,
it was a fundamental sea change from the previous century, really, of expansion of the role of government in society.
In the 1990s, Bill Clinton worked to cut about 300,000 federal jobs, mostly through retirements and the outsourcing of services. Here's Vaughn's assessment.
Certainly one of the more significant administrations in terms of reducing the role of government of the modern era.
During his first term, Donald Trump ordered a federal hiring freeze and other cuts. Now he wants his Department of Government Efficiency to finish the job. Some question the wisdom of taking a business approach to running the government. Historian James Grossman is executive director of the American Historical Association.
When you're the government, you are responsible to the people. And your goal is not to make money. Your goal is to provide services and defend the nation. There's a lot of fraud and waste in the private sector. So I'm not that sure that business people are necessarily the best people to even find out, to even discover fraud and waste.
Trump and Musk are using one tool to get their point across that wasn't available during past efforts to cut government, according to Schatz.
There can be a faster and more comprehensive response because of social media. Members of Congress tend to respond more to social media than the old-fashioned letters they used to get.
In many cases, Congress has to agree before any cuts can be made. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
Staying with President-elect Trump for a bit regarding the Middle East, he's chosen as his advisors two businessmen with whom he shares close personal ties. VOA's Michael Lippin has that story.
Donald Trump chose longtime friend Stephen Witkoff as his new special envoy to the Middle East. The New York real estate investor campaigned regularly for Trump's re-election. That close relationship will help Witkoff in the region, says national security analyst Allison McManus.
So as Witkoff does need to be traveling, to be meeting with foreign counterparts, heads of state, you know, ministerial level, he will be able to bring that kind of clout, let's say, with him, that he's somebody speaking on behalf of the president who, you know, will have that sort of authority in those settings.
In Qatar last May, Witkoff praised the Gulf state for diversifying its economic growth through government and private sector collaboration.
And I sense it in Qatar. I think that they obviously had an economy that was much more geared towards petrochemical and natural gas and things of that sort, and they're expanding. Tourism is up. The hotels here are magnificent. Mm. Who wouldn't come back to this region?
Experts note Witkoff may have to divest from some real estate deals with Gulf states to comply with U.S. laws against conflicts of interest. Again, here's Allison McManus.
It's absolutely something that is a great concern as we see some of these particularly business community figures in roles where they could both personally enrich themselves in negotiating terms that may be more favorable to certain countries like the Gulf countries, and also what that might mean in terms of their prioritization, again, of interests.
Massad Boulos will serve as Trump's senior advisor on Arab and Middle Eastern affairs. He is the father-in-law of the president-elect's daughter, Tiffany. The Lebanese-American businessman also campaigned for Trump's re-election, mobilizing Arab-American voters in the Midwestern swing state of Michigan. Boulos is a chief executive of SCOA Nigeria, a company selling trucks and heavy machinery in the West African nation. He was born to a minority Christian family in the northern Lebanese village of Kfar Aka, where his father served as mayor. Last October, Boulos said conflict in the region has kept him from returning to Lebanon. Major challenges await Trump's new Mideast team. They include Israel's ongoing conflicts with Iranian proxies in Gaza and Yemen, Iran's expanding nuclear program, Syria's chaotic emergence from dictatorial rule, and an elusive deal to normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Looking now at the ongoing civil war in Myanmar, the military government there released nearly 5,900 prisoners over the weekend. Rachel Graham of Reuters has that story.
Myanmar's military government has released thousands of prisoners under an amnesty marking the nation's Independence Day, state media said on Saturday. Among the 5,864 people freed are 180 foreign citizens, according to the broadcaster. Myanmar has been in turmoil since early 2021, when the military overthrew an elected civilian government. Military forces went on to violently suppress pro-democracy protests, sparking a nationwide armed rebellion. The junta has said it will hold elections this year, though the plan has been widely condemned by opposition groups as a sham. Among those still imprisoned by the junta is the country's former leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. The 79-year-old is serving a 27-year sentence tied to criminal charges, ranging from incitement and election fraud to corruption.
That's Rachel Graham of Reuters reporting for us, and that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.